Well, thank you, Doug. It's a real pleasure to hear my name pronounced perfectly. Okay, my background over the last few years has been study of quantum spin systems, and especially in work with Nick Reed and Senthil, we've been thinking about possible ground states of basically quantum spin systems in which you have a macroscopic moment. So these would be systems which are ferromagnets, and also how you might interpolate between ferromagnetic states and antiferromagnetic states. Then I guess last year I heard about some very interesting work of Das Sharma, Zheng, and Rathke, who had been who had made definite predictions on magnetic ordering in a double layer quantum Hall system, and we quickly realized that there was in fact an intimate relationship between these two very different systems, and you could put it all together and come up with a sort of a global understanding. So today I'll be presenting more the quantum spin system point of view, although I should emphasize that really the Hartree-Fock calculations of Das Sharma, Rathke, and Zheng were really the first to give the indications of the phases we're going to study. And also I welcome continuous interruptions while I'm speaking. Okay. This is the rough outline of the topics I'll cover. I'll begin with sort of a general introduction to what I mean by a quantum ferromagnet and what are some of the issues that we were interested in thinking about ground states of different quantum ferromagnets. There are certain conjectures that we made regarding to these systems, which we believe to be essentially exact, although we don't have any proofs. And one of the things that comes out of that is that there are really two very distinct classes of quantum ferromagnets, both of which we actually heard about in Herb Fertig's talk, in a sense. They are what are called quantized ferromagnetic states. And these are states, as I'll emphasize, in which the ground state moment is thin at some very fixed value. And quantum Hall layers precisely at 2 equals 1 are realizations of such quantized ferromagnetic states. The second type of state, which will be the major focus of my talk, are unquantized, what I call unquantized ferromagnetic states. Unquantized in quotes, because these are really states of a quantum system. They are unquantized in a sense as that the magnetic moment doesn't have to have any specific value, but can vary smoothly. And there are very interesting, we claim, realizations of such states in nu equals 2 double layers, which we'll hear about some in the next talk by Aaron Pinzuk. Now, there have also actually been two other experiments in the last couple of months on nu equals 2 double layers, which I'll also discuss, and leave Aaron Pinzuk's, which are the most complete, in a sense, detailed probe of some of these effects, to his talk. So what do I mean by a quantum ferromagnet? Well, these are basically systems in which have a macroscopic moment. So there is an overall total spin of the system. We just add up the spins of all the electrons. And this obeys, of course, the usual spin commutation algebra. And I'll be thinking, in general, of Hamiltonian of this type. There's H1, which is the main part of the Hamiltonian, which includes the Coulomb interactions and the various exchange interactions in the system. And this part commutes completely with the total spin. I'll also, partly because of the physical instrument of the quantum Hall system, add a term that breaks the spin rotation symmetry, but that'll be a simple linear term, just a overall uniform field. And this can be reasonably strong, but not so strong that the idea of a spontaneous magnetic moment loses its meaning. So I'll define the T equals zero magnetization in the ground state, which is the average of the expectation value of S total divided by the system volume. And so in the sense of general quantum systems, this is a very interesting class of system, which is not even now not completely understood, because you have a system in which you have a conserved charge, the generator of rotation, which is the total spin, and it happens to be identical to the order parameter. And this leads to certain complications. And one of our motivations was to try and understand the kind of constraints this identity leads to possible transitions in phases at zero temperature. So there are plenty of examples of this. And of course, here the interest are the quantum Hall systems. So as I've already mentioned, they're basically, just by studying all known examples, you find they seem to fall into two basic classes, which I call quantized and unquantized ferromagnets. And quantized ferromagnets are, in a sense, the simplest ones. there and for which we have a reasonably general theory of low energy fluctuations. And these are systems which are M0, the ground state magnetization, is pinned at some simple value. So like a fully polarized Landau level where all the electrons are up, and so the ground state magnetization is precisely 1/2 per electron. Or you could imagine more complicated pinnings where because of possibly broken transnational symmetry, the pinning is at some, you have a larger unit cell, but in any case you have integer or half integer spin per unit cell. Now these kind of systems have basically one very important low energy excitation, and that's spin waves. It's defined in terms of the ground state, whose dispersion is defined in terms of the ground state magnetization M0 and the spin stiffness rho s. That measures the energy for slow twists of the order parameter. And it has a quadratic dispersion with its precise coefficient, and it requires a small gap when you turn on a field. Now the other interesting system are unquantized ferromagnets, and of which also there are many examples, but there is no simple unifying general theory for them, as far as I know. And these are systems which M0, the average magnetization of the ground state, can vary continuously. It doesn't have to be pinned at any special value. And in fact, these Kerm crystals that Herb talked about this morning is an example of such a phase, I think excluding the more insulating phases that he had in one of his phase diagrams. And so one of the assertions we made in this paper, based upon really looking at a whole class of quantum spin systems, is that whenever you get such a system, there has to be some additional gapless excitation. And we saw already an example of that in Herb's talk. There was this linear spin wave mode of the in-plane ordering. And this is what we're claiming, this existence of this additional gapless excitation, which has nothing to do with the spin waves, is really necessary for getting such states. And crudely speaking, it's because of these gapless excitations that the system is able to, you know, continuously flip spins and allow M0 to vary continuously as it varies some parameter. So one simple example, which all of you know, is really the simplest example of ferromagnet we studied, the Stoner theory of a ferromagnet in a Fermi liquid. And here, you've got two Fermi surfaces, one spins up and spins down, and by varying the relative size of the Fermi surfaces, which you can by varying some parameter, you can continuously vary the ground state average magnetization. Now, the system does have a spin wave, but it also has an excitation at finite k going from one Fermi surface to the other, which has zero energy, and it's this additional gapless excitation which seems to be necessary for any such unquantized ferromagnet. And these excitations remain gapless even for non-zero H, unlike these. Okay, I'm probably not going fast enough. All right, so the first part of the talk is on quantized ferromagnets, and here I'll refer to some of the things Sean Barrett talked about in applications to nu equals 1 quantum layer. So what are the issues? Here I want to sit precisely at nu equals 1, in which the ground state is completely known, and think about what happens at finite temperature. Now, this kind of thing has been studied in quantum ferromagnets going back to 1956 in work of Dyson, and what he looked at was a three-dimensional ferromagnet. And in a sense, there's a simplicity in three dimensions because of a clear separation between sort of classical critical effects and quantum effects. So in zero field, in three dimensions, your magnetization is finite in ground state and then vanishes at some critical temperature TC. Now, if you turn on a finite field, then there will be some increase in the magnetization down here. And all of this low temperature behavior is what was described by essentially the exact description of Dyson in terms of quantum spin waves and their weak interactions. The point where the magnetization vanishes, we well know at zero field is described by well-known classical critical theory, and the rounding of this singularity is then completely given in a simple class, not a simple, a classical theory of classical critical phenomena will describe how this curve rounds out in the presence of a field. A two-dimension thing's a little more interesting, because in zero field you have a very singular dependence on magnetization and temperature. So if your G factor was strictly zero in a quantum Hall system, then your magnetization would be finite and equal to this quantized value at zero temperature, but will be zero at any non-zero temperature. So in a sense, these two regions have merged into the same zero temperature point. And so in finite field, the magnetization curves that you're going to observe, which were first measured by Sean in his NMR experiments, are going to require a more tightly coupled theory which treats both the quantum and the classical effects. So I guess the theory for this is alluded to by Herb, but this is rather generally any such quantized ferromagnet is described by a low energy Lagrangian of this type, where the important order parameter is just a unit vector n, which gives you the orientation of the local ferromagnetic moment. And then its quantum fluctuations in space time are described by this very simple action, all of whose coefficients and couplings are known precisely. So there's the stiffness term where the coefficient is rho s, and in many cases, like the nu equals 1 quantum Hall layer, this rho s can be computed exactly as was done by Kaolin and Halperin many years ago. There's a coupling to the external field with the coefficient which is precisely m0. And then there's this very phase term which imposes the spin commutation rules. Just make sure that you get the right quantum operators from this field n. And its coefficient is also precisely m0. Now this term makes sense, can be defined as a unique value only in a system, in a continuum system of volume L to the D, provided 2m0 L to the D as an integer. And again, there's this quantization condition coming in, telling you that somehow this m0 ground state magnetization has to be pinned at a very specific value. Now this continuum theory by itself actually is ill-defined in the strict sense, and you always need some kind of short-distance regularization. But there is, in a sense, near to or below to the parameters in the continuum theory define sort of a universal behavior in the way the magnetization behaves as a function of field and temperature at low temperatures. And basically, formally, this is rather a mathematical statement that what you can show using some RG analyses of this action is that below two dimensions, that an expansion in inverse in powers of T over rho s is well defined, and to all orders in this expansion, you're going to get universal functions of H over T, which describe the quantum classical crossover. And in principle, these can all be computed. So universal in the sense they don't depend on anything except these parameters already in the Hamiltonian. Precisely in D equals 2, even in this particular expansion, you expect logarithmic corrections. So D equals 2 in a crude sense is the upper critical dimension. And so the precise system you're looking at, say a lattice ferromagnet as opposed to a quantum Hall system, will start to matter, but only in logarithmic terms. I guess, and for the mathematically, I guess, precise, defining a function in all orders in some expansion doesn't define the whole function there. When T becomes of order rho s in any dimension, you get sort of lattice-dependent effects that you do have to worry about. Okay, now this kind of series of the universal low-temperature behavior can be computed or partially resummed in a 1 over n expansion, and in this paper we introduced two separate 1 over n expansions of the same underlying quantum theory, depending on generalizing the symmetry of the ferromagnet to SUN or ON. I computed the predictions at n equals infinity. Subsequently, there's recent work of Tim, Gervin, Helenius, and Sandvik, who computed all of the 1 over n corrections and also did Monte Carlo simulations of certain lattice ferromagnets. And the results of such a computation are shown here. I should also mention there's also work of this temperature band magnetization by Kastner and McDonald using a more Hartree-Fock picture. I do believe that at low temperatures, this particular continuum approach is, however, the correct point of view, because the Hartree-Fock picture would miss the simple effect that I talked about earlier, that the magnetization is zero at all non-zero temperatures at zero field. Okay, so now with all the parameters are completely known, there are no adjustable parameter whatsoever. The stiffness from the Kaolin-Halperin calculation, the field, and the ground state magnetization. And this is compared in this slide with the magneto-absorption measurements in Bennett-Goldfuss group at BU of the magnetization of a nu equals 1 layer. And as you can see, that the 1 over n corrected ON expansion actually works remarkably well for a very wide temperature range with no free parameters. The 101 correction of the SUN mean field theory actually makes the agreement much worse. That comes way down here. And we don't really understand fundamentally why the ON should be better than SUN. Although Steve will verify that before they did the corrections, I conjecture there will be. Okay. All right, so that completes the first third of my talk, I guess. Good. All right, sorry. Please correct me. Okay, I don't know which. This is the this paper or the subsequent paper?
This paper.
I see.
Okay.
Oh, I see. So it just comes from the fact that bosons in two dimensions have a zero TC, even free bosons. It comes from that effect. Okay. All right, but it's nevertheless true that you get predictions which are way out here. Don't fall off fast enough. Okay. Okay, I don't remember. All right, well, I think, okay, so I'm corrected. Thank you. I see. All right. Okay, so now I'm going to the next part of my talk. We're going to talk about two layers. So we imagine taking two of these ferromagnets, precisely at nu equals 1, and bringing them close to each other, as we hear about in the next experiment. So the theoretical point of view I'm going to take is you've got these two layers in which the important excitation is just the spins. Their charge is precisely, there's a gap to all charge excitations. And so when we bring them together, it seems reasonable to just ignore the charge entirely and just focus on how the spins interact with each other. So one consequence of that is that this so-called layer pseudo-spin order that we heard about a bit in, I guess, R.D. Stern's talk, which corresponds to the one-on-one state, would really require strong charge fluctuation between the two layers because it has long-range order in a conjugate phase. And so any kind of pseudo-spin order is, in a sense, thrown out right at the very beginning in any such approach. Doesn't mean they couldn't be there, but we think it's reasonable that the most important excitations have to do simply with the spin, and that you have a charge gap everywhere, and that's consistent with all the current experiments, even at sort of quantum critical points in different phases. So now you bring these two layers together, so you have basically a continuum quantum ferromagnetic action for the two layers, and then you. The simplest way you can couple them is by an exchange term between the two layers. What you can see by the usual type of super exchange arguments is that this kind of exchange is going to be anti-ferromagnetic. Now, I guess there were calculations of Yang, Rodkinder, Sharma which showed this in the Hartree-Fock calculation, but you can sort of crudely try to estimate it also by the usual super exchange arguments where you'd get the exchanges of order the square of the Hopping matrix element divided by some Coulomb energy on a single layer. Okay, so this is now the model I want to study, but I'm going to do it, being a quantum spin person, by thinking of it as a quantum spin Hamiltonian and seeing what are the phases you can get. In fact, and this type of analysis I had done long before I heard about Shankar's calculation, which then got me really excited. Okay. So I'm going to take each layer and just put it on a square lattice, for example. So we'll have then spins sitting on a square lattice in two layers, coupled within a layer with an intra-layer exchange, which I call J. And for the quantum Hall system, this has to be ferromagnetic. But for theoretical purposes, it's very useful to also allow it to be anti-ferromagnetic. So I'm going to allow J to have either sign. And the intra-layer exchange in red is going to be anti-ferromagnetic, J perp. So now you have a single dimensionless ratio, which is J over J perp, and also a second one, which is the strength of the field divided by J perp. And you can try to map out the phase diagram of this model as a function of these two parameters. And in fact, that phase diagram is now extremely well known to, all the phase boundaries are known to three significant figures based upon a whole host of Monte Carlo simulations, strong coupling expansions by Gelfand and Singh, and also some high temperature expansion. So I'm going to put up this phase diagram here and refer to it in much of the next part of my talk. So the two axes here are the two-dimensional parameters. Take the intra-layer exchange between the two layers. Keep that up for a minute. J perp as my unit of energy, in a sense. So this is the interlayer exchange on this axis, and this is the field divided by J perp on that axis. And we're going to now look at all the possible phases that you could get in this two-parameter model. Okay, so let's start by a very simple limit where I put all intralayer exchange equal to zero. All interlayer exchange equal to zero. So in that case, the system just decouples into pairs of spins in opposite layers. So you've got one spin here, coupled with an interaction J perp, and there's the field which couples the total spin, and any such pair of spins is completely uncoupled with all other spins. And that corresponds to this axis here, vertical axis right here. So of course this problem we can solve. And it's simply there's a singlet and a triplet when H equals zero. When you turn on the field, the triplet, lower triplet comes down in energy and eventually crosses. So you have a ground state, which is a singlet between these two layers at low field, and then large enough field, you have a triplet state with all spins up. And the total magnetization in both cases is just precisely 0 or 1, as is the average magnetization. So this jump from here to there is this line over there. So this state here, then, is a spin singlet where the spins on the two layers just form a simple valence bond, and there's a whole series of this across the entire square lattice. And up here, the spins are all up, and so this is a quantized ferromagnet in the sense that the magnetization per spin or per site is exactly 1. And now we're going to think about what happens as you move away from this line. So if I imagine, for example, I turn on an anti-ferromagnetic J and look what happens here, then you find that this jump in the magnetization actually splits into two critical points, which can also be understood fairly straightforwardly. So now instead of jumping continuously from here to there, you have the magnetization varying in between 0 and 1. And so this phase down here in between would be an example of an unquantized ferromagnet, which has been labeled so over here. Now, precisely the same phenomenon also happens for the other sign of J, but the position of the phase boundaries are somewhat different. And these are also known extremely accurately. So how do I think about these two points? Well, let's start up here, where you started with a state with all spins up. So the simplest thing to do is just flip one of the spins when you couple the various dimers together. And that one flip spin, which is a delta SZ equals minus 1 excitation, is going to travel through the lattice. And it's simply effectively just a free boson moving through the lattice. And as the chemical potential of the boson goes through the bottom of its band, precisely at that position, this boson will condense. This SZ equals 1 boson will condense. And you're going to get some of the phase where, as I'll argue shortly, you're going to have an order which is canted in the sense that you have order in the XY plane, which is long-range order, rather like, in that sense, very analogous to the Sturm-Crystal order, although here the in-plane structure is much simpler. And the vertical component of the magnetization varies continuously. Now, conversely, you can start from the other side, where the ground state is just a singlet. And then when you try to couple these singlets together, you have to look at the excited state. And the excited state is just this, both spins up. It's a triplet particle. And relative to the ground state, it's also a delta SZ equals 1 excitation. And again, this particular excitation can hop through the lattice. And when its chemical potential crosses zero, you're going to have a critical point where you're going to get into the same phase, essentially, because you can quickly see that with all its characteristics, the nature of the spin ordering and and the behavior of the magnetization as a function of this axis are basically the same. Now, these two points are, in a sense, quantum critical points, but they're not terribly useful or interesting in a sense, because they correspond essentially to free bosons going through the bottom of the band, and interaction effects are relatively weak. Now, I guess in Aaron Pinzock's talk, we're going to hear about various excitations he measures by light scattering, and what this particular excitation, a single flip spin relative to the fully polarized ferromagnet, is what he calls an SW excitation, and this particular excitation he calls a spin density excitation. So we're going to see characteristic spectra of these in the next talk, but this simple picture will hopefully give you an intuitive understanding of what they are. Okay, so as I've already mentioned, as I go up here on a phase boundary over here, at these two points you have condensation of spin 1 particles, Sc equals minus 1 here, Sc equals plus 1 here, and that implies long range order, because once you have, you know, this is the number variable corresponding to the particle which condenses, and therefore the conjugate phase variable must have long range order, that's just Sx plus Isy. So you have long range order in the xy plane. And if the in-plane coupling is anti-ferromagnetic, this basically all that is going to happen between different sites on a layer is that the in-plane order is going to flip back and forth at the wave vector pi pi. Whereas over here, the in-plane coupling is ferromagnetic, then you'll get exactly the spin same orientation on every site. So that's what these correspond to. So these are states with this kind of order, which is called canted. And these are also, in a sense, unquantized ferromagnets, because the ferromagnetic moment can vary continuously. It doesn't have to be pinned to any particular value. And because of the broken symmetry in the xy plane, there are Galois spin waves with a linear dispersion relation in a manner closely analogous to Herb's talk. Okay, so we've basically now understood all four phases and identified these lines, the simple Bose condensation lines of spin 1 bosons. And now I want to do something different. I want to go down here and take the limit of zero field and look at the horizontal axis. And where you're going to find rather different types of quantum critical points, which allow us to make rather definite quantitative predictions that will be very useful to test experimentally. So, for example, if I now imagine moving from here to here at zero field, now remember, when I moved vertically, I took an excitation above the single ground strip, which just both spins up, and asked when it condensed. When I move over here, I'm no longer free to just pull out the Sz equals 1 excitation as opposed to the Sz equals 0 or Sz equals minus 1 excitation. They're all degenerate, exactly, because you have full rotational symmetry. And so you really have to think of all three of these coming together at the same time, while maintaining complete rotational symmetry. And so you might expect that this particular point here, where this order disappears, is going to be rather different. Also, where this singlet phase vanishes, it's going to be rather different. Also, when the field goes to zero, the canted phase, which has long range order in the xy plane, will in the end will limit to a simple nail phase, because the spins have no particular incentive anymore to have a ferromagnetic moment. They just point in opposite orientations in the two layers. Okay, so then we can then ask about the nature of the transition from the spin singlet phase to the nail phase, and that we know from the work of Haldane and Chakravarti Halbwohl-Nelson is described by a nonlinear sigma model. And in this particular context, that's also very easy to derive. Remember, you had two layers, each of which was a ferromagnet, so the quantum Hall system really corresponds to this side of the phase diagram. And so you can define sort of a staggered variable N and uniform magnetization L in this manner. And when you integrate out the fluctuations of uniform magnetization, you end up with this particular action. Now, what I've done here is actually also include the effect of a finite field. It's very useful then to think about what happens as you turn the field up near this point. And the way the field appears is precisely in this sort of gauge-like coupling, telling you essentially that all the field does is precess the spin uniformly at a uniform rate about its axis. Now, one thing to notice is that this particular action, the presence of a field, is no longer real. There is even an imaginary time, there's an I there. And that I is simply accounting for the fact that you also pick up a Berry phase when the spin precesses about the orientation of the magnetic field. So this particular field theory is really a quantum field theory in the true sense, in that you won't get it as an effective action for some classical theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions. The other interesting thing is, of course, that once you have a field theory of this type, that its upper dimension is now 3. So in 2 dimensions, you get strong interactions between the excitations, and that can lead to interesting universal effects that could be measured experimentally. Okay, so now, for any non-zero field, as I've said, this xy order in the plane in both of these phases, and so complete analogy with Herbstock, you'd expect some kind of phase transition at finite temperature, a costless solids transition where that xy order disappears. So there's some, if I extend this phase diagram in the vertical direction, there's some finite temperature phase boundary which vanishes as you approach either of these lines. And we want to now think about the nature of that phase boundary. In particular, a very interesting direction to look at is to come into that come into this point vertically as a function of field, and there's not an unreasonable hope that you can achieve some approximation of that in some experiments, and then to ask about what happens to the finite temperature phase transition, and how does the critical temperature approach zero as you approach this point. Now, the reason for introducing the two sides will become clear shortly. I mean, of course, physically we're always on the ferromagnetic side of the in-plane coupling. This particular analysis of the nonlinear sigma model works equally either here or there. So numerically, you can then test any particular prediction you make at these two separate critical points. And if our understanding is correct, you should get the same answers in the two shaded regions. So one of the predictions that we like very much, which we think would be an exciting direction for future experiments, is to just look at the critical temperature as you approach, I guess experimentally you're approaching this point M2, but numerically we can approach either of these two points. And the simple sort of scaling arguments, simple in a sense, tell you that the costless solids temperature should be just proportional to the external magnetic field. So this is something you can measure, this is something you can measure. There are no corrections whatsoever to either of these two quantities. And kappa, then, we claim, is a universal number. And it's a number reflecting the underlying quantum mechanics of the excitations and the interactions, and doesn't depend and the nature of this critical point and our understanding of it, and doesn't depend upon any microscopic details. And so where does this come from? Well, it essentially comes from the fact that this particular point is, in a sense, a scale-invariant field theory, and the only scale around when you turn on a field is the magnetic field. Furthermore, the magnetic field has no renormalization whatsoever because it has a very special gauge symmetry telling you that it just precesses spins at a uniform rate. And so you've got two energy scales, the temperature and the field, and they must be proportional to each other, universal coefficient. So what's also more interesting, this function cap number kappa, unlike many other universal quantities that have been computed in 2 plus 1 dimensions earlier, is really a quantum mechanical universal number because it relies on a field theory with complex phase factors and Berry phases. That doesn't mean that in all representations you're going to get complex phase factors. In part of the quantum Monte Carlo results that I'll describe shortly, you can make all the weights real, but in any such representation you'll find that you have to quantize spin. So the quantum Monte Carlo then depends upon sort of quantized loops of word lines carrying integral units of spin. You can never find a representation for this universal number kappa, which depends on some continuous spin field theory with positive weights. So in that sense, it's a rather exciting prospect if it could be measured in subsequent experiments. And it would really then test our understanding of the nature of the universality of transitions between magnetically ordered states and paramagnets in two dimensions. So what we've done, I guess I should mention this is really The quantum Monte Carlo work, as I think I put his name up earlier, was done with Matthias Troyer in a supercomputer in Japan. So what he measures in over here and also over there, and we know the position of these two points to about three significant figures. And so you just sit at one of those points and then put on a field, measure the spin stiffness to twist in the plane as a function of temperature. In this word line Monte Carlo algorithm, where you're looking at a collection of continuous time word lines with quantized spin units on every word line. I guess some of the Bose gas simulations in Steve Gerben's group for the Bose glass to superfluid transition also relied on very similar word line type representation. But here, I think we have a real clean system within a possibility of an experimental test, which makes it quite interesting. So, I got sidetracked. The spin stiffness as a function of temperature then shows its behavior as you increase the system size. So, at very small system times, well, you don't get anything interesting. But eventually, for large enough system size, you see this, what appears to be limiting to a jump in the infinite size limit, and this would be the universal costless powerless jump. This is the line at which that should occur, universal Nelson costless jump. And this is the line where that should occur. So this ratio of pi over 2 is the Nelson costless ratio. Now, in fact, you can do a little better. There's a theory due to Weber and Minhagen on how this ratio of the stiffness to temperature would scale in the costless powerless transition as a function of system size. And so you do an appropriate plot, which should tell you that these curves should diverge to minus infinity for temperatures below TKT and to plus infinity for temperatures above TKT. And that allows you to fairly accurately identify where the costless powerless temperature is. And then you measure that at various points. See, the costless powerless temperature vanishes here and then vanishes again over there. And what we found that as long as you are sort of roughly halfway between these two points, it was very linear coming down to this point. And similarly here, and you found that the ratio, kappa, was precisely the same at both critical points to the accuracy of a numerical simulation. And the slope, final value of the slope, was around 0.38. And these are very conservative error bars. The actual error bars, we believe, are probably much smaller. And I guess all of these simulations were done by Matthias Troyer, who has one of the world's best continuous time algorithms to run on parallel computers. Okay, so this is the one of our main predictions, which we hope could be tested in some of the experiments that Aaron is going to describe in his next talk. Okay, we can do actually quite a bit more, but not with that accuracy. Yes.
On the tunneling also, because the Sigma model doesn't have tunneling. Sigma model has just a Heisenberg exchange, right?
Well, the exchange comes from tunneling.
No, that I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, it's preserved. I mean, what it requires is the existence of a charge gap, that's all. And that our understanding of universality in quantum sense systems, you know, there could be, it's leaving out sort of buried phases associated with, or at least in the continuum calculation, associated with the hedgehogs or various other tunneling events, and we believe those are all irrelevant in a formal sense, although there's never been a real confirmation of that. And so I guess there's also an epsilon expansion you can do below three dimensions, which is rather crude, and that gives you a value of kappa to leading order an epsilon, which is around 0.6. So it's in the same ballpark from this numerical simulation. Yeah. That's right. So the question is, what units am I using? No, in fact, the TKT is proportional to the Zeeman energy, full stop. It doesn't depend on the ratio, on the exchange at all, provided you're at this critical point. I mean, the whole point is that the exchange determines the position of M1, but once you found it, then it doesn't depend on what the exchange is. Yeah. I'm not going to, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right. It's relevant, but these are rather clean systems, so. Of course, that then problem becomes too complicated. I mean, I guess, so you know, if you're working, I guess that may be a reason not to approach this point too close. If you're, you know, reasonably high temperatures, then this order shouldn't matter. But those are all surmises, and so this remains to be seen if this works. Okay, I have about 5 more minutes left with 5 plus 5. Okay. So the other things we can do, which I'll just briefly allude to, is actually compute dynamic response functions at finite temperature for light scattering experiments in the entire window of this critical point in an expansion in 3 minus d. And so there are other detailed predictions of the nature of the spectrum in this particular expansion, but of course one shouldn't go about fitting those details before this very crude prediction of the temperature itself is seen to work or not. I guess one of the things you can imagine plotting the phase diagram then, say, as a function of in this direction at right, coming out this way at finite field, then you have a costless Collis temperature which vanishes as you hit this boundary. And in this entire region over here, you can then compute things in terms of universal functions, in terms of deviation from this point. And one of the things you'll find in this expansion anyway is that there's some kind of a quote-unquote pseudo-gap type behavior. This phase here is a gap with a spin density excitation. But if you raise the temperature close enough to this point above TKT, then you would see reappearance of that gap above the costless Collis temperature. And that's something that seems to be consistent with what Aaron is seeing, so perhaps indicating it's not so far away from this point for this picture to be completely useless. I guess, as I've emphasized several times, this kind of phase diagram for this particular system was first worked out by Jang, Rodkin, and Sharma in a Hartree-Fock calculation, and they get these three phases, which are basically analogous to these three phases here, these three here. The whole thing has to flip around. This ferromagnetic phase is the FPF phase over there. AF is what I'm calling C, and the narrow symmetric is what I'm calling SS. Now, the advantage of this approach, of course, is that you can put in actual numbers, which none of this can do. So you can plot things over as a function of experimentally measured known parameters. And for the two samples of Pellegrini et al., you find that are expected to be these two points. Now, from the experiments, it's, as Aaron will argue, what you seem to find actually that this particular sample is in the symmetric phase. And that's a feature of the Hartree-Fock calculation, that it overestimates the energy of the symmetric phase, because really the physics of the symmetric phase, in a sense, or the spin singlet phase, just two electrons in opposite layer forming a spin singlet. Whereas in a Hartree-Fock approach, you would just take some symmetric wave function with the two layers and occupy both spin up and down states. And in such a state, you're occupying the two electrons on the same layer half the time. And they really don't want to do that. So that's consistent with the fact that that it overestimates the stability of the candidate of antiferromagnetic phase relative to the experiments. Okay, so in the time remaining, I just want to mention briefly the three recent experiments. I should emphasize that being a theorist and not actually having talked to any of the experimentalists, my understanding of these is not yet complete, but I'll just talk about them, just present the data, and leave them as food for thought. So the most detailed experiment is really experiment of Pellegrini-Pinzuk, which Aaron will talk about shortly, so I won't say anything further about it. And I'll just mention the other two experiments which have appeared also in the last few months. The first experiment was Sawada, Izawa et al., a group in Japan, and the second one is by Lok, Mann, and several other people in a group in Nijmegen. So let's talk about the first experiment of Sawada et al., which is basically a transport measurement. And this is the kind of measurements they're doing. They've got a nu equals 2, the double layer system with these parameters here. and a measure, for example, Rxy, the Hall resistance, as a function at various different total density. This is one value of the total density of the sample. But one thing they can do is independently vary the density of the front and the back quantum well. So they have gates here and gates here, and by applying voltage, they can sort of look at the balanced and unbalanced configurations. So they plot the Hall conductance as a function of the deviation in density, the breaking of symmetry. So the system that I've been talking about here is basically this equal to zero. And what they look at as a function of this breaking of symmetry between the two wells are the widths of the various Hall plateaus. And we're interested, of course, in the widths at nu equals 2, but by comparison, they also look at nu equals 1 and nu equals 2/3. So I guess since time is running out, I won't be able to really... Fine. I have 5 more minutes, so then I can describe the experiment a little more slowly. Okay, so at nu equals 2/3, here's what it is. So if I look at the width of the Hall plateau, that's the vertical axis, as a function of the difference in density of the two layers. And nu equals 2/3, really, if you think of it as this kind of state. We have 2 1/3 states fully polarized. So now if you deviate the density, change the chemical potential of the two layers, some of these spins are going to want to go there. But because of the Pauli exclusion principle, they can't. They're both pointing up. So any kind of deviation in the density is terrible for such a state. And sure enough, they find that as soon as they change the density away from the balance point, the width plummets to zero. Now, at nu equals 1, they see something very different. There, you've got a state which I guess they believe is the 1-1-1 state, where you've got lots of charge fluctuations between two layers and the spins just occupying a symmetric orbital between the two, with all spins up. And in this case, I guess because you've got nu equals 1/2 in each layer, it's not that it's relatively straightforward, the electrons to move off to the other layer, because there's plenty of space in the lowest Landau level. And they seem to find that the width of the plateau now increases as a function of the balance configuration. Now at nu equals 2, they see something rather dramatic as they change the density, the total density of the electrons. First, I guess in the highest density samples, they see a behavior which is rather like the nu equals 2/3 behavior. That is, as you change the unbalanced, as you go to the unbalanced configuration, the Hall width, the width of the plateau seems to decrease. And this seems consistent with being in a state like this. But if you go to much lower densities, then you see behavior rather like the nu equals 1 there, where the width actually increases as you unbalance the system. And that's roughly consistent with being either of this or this phase, because now you've got spins in opposite orientation, and if you unbalance it, they like to basically move or occupy the same Landau level. And they can do that. The Pauli principle doesn't exclude it. Their interpretation on this is slightly different, but in the end, they're really talking about the same state. The way they think about it is that they think of nu equals 2 as two copies of the nu equals 1 state, the 1-1-1 state, one each for opposite spins. So what they think of, the way they think about it, you've got one symmetric level, and you first occupy with up spin, and then you occupy with down spin. But that's not exactly like the Hartree-Fock picture, and it's really continuously connected to the picture here, where I'm thinking of it more in terms of super exchange spin sitting in opposite layers. So it's really the same state. And so you see clearly something going on as a function of density. They can't map out details of the phase diagram. We would predict that there should really be an intermediate phase. There are really two boundaries, generically, on the basis of the Hartree-Fock calculation. But that still remains to be seen from this data. Okay. The other experiment is, okay, they have much more data, which is all consistent with these interpretations. And the other experiment is not as detailed. It's the work of Loke, Mann et al. In Nijmegen, and they're looking at whole gas in gallium arsenide quantum wells. And the basic effect they see is this little feature right here. So they look at Rxx and Rxy as a function of magnetic field, and right at nu equals 2, they see hysteresis. Depending on whether they sweep the field up or sweep the field down, you see rather different values of Rxy. And their interpretation is that this has to do with some kind of magnetic order appearing at nu equals 2. And so the system likes to split up, if you're not exactly at nu equals 2, rather than like magnetic systems, the system likes to split up into tiny little domains where part of these domains are precisely at nu equals 2 and the remainder is not, because they believe there's some special commensuration energy to a magnetically ordered state precisely at nu equals 2. I guess it's not entirely, so this is rather indirect, and it's not entirely clear this is the same phenomenon as the other experiment. Hopefully that will be understood in future work. Sorry? Yeah. Okay, that's possible. I have to think about that. I didn't think of that. Okay, so just to summarize, what I've talked about are, at least from a quantum spin point of view, two different types of ferromagnetic systems, one with a quantized ferromagnetic moment and the other with a continuously varying ferromagnetic moment. The nu equals 1 layers are extremely nice realization of two-dimensional quantum ferromagnets. And there's certainly rather precise agreement with no free parameters of particular large and expansion in the magnetization measurements. At nu equals 2, there are, I guess, early experiments of Pinsuk et al., which motivated Zheng, Rutke, and Sharma to make more specific predictions on the nature of the phases that appear. And we looked at the consequences of those predictions in a sort of a more field theoretical perspective, and made rather detailed predictions that could be hopefully tested in future experiments, one of which is just the value of the critical temperature being proportional to just the Zeeman energy with a highly non-trivial proportionality constant, which would be really one of the first, if measured, would be one of the first measurements of a sort of a universal quantum number of a quantum critical point in a two-dimensional system. And this is one of the cleanest and best tunable realizations of phase transitions in quantum spin systems in two dimensions. I hope that work will be done in future. Well, thank you very much. It doesn't. The position of M1 changes, but nothing else changes. That's why it's a good thing to look at. So one way to do this experiment is actually perhaps apply pressure and tune the value of G factor and try to really, while keeping other parameters fixed, be able to tune just the Zeeman energy.
As I understand it, you built this theory of a double layer system.
Yeah. Right, right.
In double layer systems, another type of order can occur, which is spontaneous interlayer phase.
Yes.
Have you thought about how that could fit into?
Okay, I refer to that briefly. I mean, I guess the idea here is that each layer, when they're far apart, has a gap to charge excitation. So unlike nu equals 1, when you have the two layers are really gapless states, so you have two gap states coming together. So when you have a charge gap, you are then suppressing the phase variable you're talking about, interlayer coherence, is conjugate to the charge difference between the two layers. So if you're suppressing all charge fluctuations, it seems reasonable to just focus on the spin. I didn't show the data of Sawada et al., who actually measured the activation gap across this putative phase condition, the charge activation gap from the transport. And what they see is that the activation gaps remain finite everywhere, even at the critical point. So this is the activation energy as a function of total density. This is the nu equals 2. And you see, it doesn't go to 0. It's always finite. So as long...
charge gap in each layer, I guess.
Yes, yeah. So I agree. Of course, this kind of field theory can't rule out anything. But as far as we can tell, this is what's happening. Now, there could be other exotic phases where you do have interlayer phase coherence. But
that's
we don't need. Sorry?
The analysis assuming this time, kind of spin under the 1-1-1 step.
Well, they're taking two of the, I mean, the point is if you have any interlayer tunneling at all, and you take two of one-on-one states, one spin up, spin down, that state is nothing but the spin singlet. It has no other quantum numbers except that.
It's tunneling. In the presence of tunneling, this is the whole story. There is no other interlayer state. Without tunneling, what you are saying is wrong. In the presence of tunneling, this is the whole story.
Okay, well. Well, okay, I mean, I agree, you're absolutely right, there could be other phases, but this is our best of our understanding at this point.
So, I mean, the critical point is that the spin quantum number in each individual layer is not strictly a separate quantum number. The Hamiltonian does not commute under, or isn't the variant under.
That's correct. That's correct. I'm approximation making is just neglecting all charge fluctuations. That the layer, the charge density in each layer remains pinned.
Yeah,
at
layer.
Yes, that's correct. But that approximation will not affect the value of kappa. That's a universal number.
Yeah. To measure kappa, you need to know the g factor.
Sure.
So how well can we measure that?
Well, I guess you can measure the G factor at some other density by an ESR experiment. No, but you need to know the proportionality between pressure and the field. Yeah, you can do ESR. You can do ESR or some other experiment to look for it.
Okay.
Okay.
G factor is very different from two G factors. So there's still spinorbit interaction.
Well, but the whole point is spin orbit interaction is much smaller than either the field energy or the, I guess, and the exchange energy. Now, I guess you're saying strictly when the field goes all the way to zero, then the spin orbit may be. There will maybe some residual spin anisotropy which will make things lousy right all the way down there.
Right.
That's a valid point.
I guess we have this one.